For refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. From the virtuous merit I create by listening to the teachings, may I attain the state of a Buddha to be able to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. From the virtuous merit I collect by listening to the teachings, may I attain the state of Buddha to be able to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the highest assembly. From the virtuous merit I collect by listening to the teachings, may I attain the state of a Buddha to be able to benefit all sentient beings. So good morning, everybody. Today, the afternoon schedule, we're going to alter it a little bit and still have the discussion at 1:30, but we're going to go from have a session from 1:30 till 3:30 and then finish at 3:30. So we'll do the discussion for about an hour and then have some debriefing, and then I'll continue with the text, and we'll see how far we get until 3:30, okay? And then I have some blessed pills from Dharamsala that I'll give out at the very end to all of those of you who want. Okay, so sometimes when we study this text, you know, of Wheel of Sharp Weapons, we think, gee, Dharma Rakshita knows all my faults. And how come he has to say them so publicly? Yeah, how come he has to point them out so vividly in front of everybody else? You know? And so we feel a little bit vulnerable because, I mean, he is pointing out all of our faults. And one thing that I found very valuable in my practice is to relax when my faults are being pointed out and to kind of rejoice, because when I am able to see my faults, then I can do something about them. When I can't see them, then of course I can't do anything and they just continue as they are. And this, you know, this idea we have sometimes, like, geez, pointing out all my faults in front of everybody else, I don't want to look so bad. Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, most people know our faults already. Yeah, it's only us who think they don't. So it's only us who want to keep our faults hidden. Because the people that we live with, they know our faults, don't they? Hello? Don't they know your faults? I mean, our faults are there and people see them. And it's only us that goes, oh, you're not supposed to notice them. But other people do. So when we recognize that this is the reality of the situation, then our minds can relax a little bit and be more transparent we don't have to cover things up and to pretend to be somebody we're not, because we recognize that everybody sees this stuff anyway. Yeah? So it's like, you know, we have a nose on our face, and somebody comes along and says, "You have a nose." And what are we going to do? Say, "No, I don't." Yeah? So, you know, when we can become more comfortable with and more transparent and realize that it's not really such a big deal that other people see our faults. Yeah? And that we can acknowledge our faults in front of them because they know them anyway. So who are we trying to hide them from besides ourselves? Okay, so we relax and become more transparent. And this also helps us to become more accepting of ourselves. You know, yes, I have faults. Yes, everybody sees them. Surprise, I'm no different than anybody else. Yeah, we're all in the same boat. So I don't really need to fear things. And I can own what's mine. And I can also have compassion for other people because they probably feel the same way I do about having faults and not wanting other people to recognize them, even though we all do. Yeah. And so just as I want people to treat me kindly in spite of my problems and my faults, then I think, okay, other people the same way. They want to be treated kindly despite their problems and their faults too. Okay, so it brings more self-acceptance, more ability to have compassion for others instead of always trying to put on an image. Yeah, because we do that a lot, don't we? We put on a face. We create an image. Look at me. I'm this kind of person. Yeah? And we expect other people to believe it. So sometimes we have a few different images. You know, sometimes our identity is, as we talked a few days ago, my victim image, you know. I'm the victim of this person abused me and that person abused me. The message being, don't you dare hurt my feelings. Yeah? When we have our victim thing, the message is, don't you dare hurt my feelings. Because if you do, you're bad, just like all these other people who abuse me. Yeah? So that's a little bit manipulative, don't you think? So, you know, that's sometimes our identity. And when people refuse to believe that identity that we're a victim, then we squirm. When people refuse to treat us as if we're some pitiful thing that the world has treated unjustly and therefore we're entitled to something that other people aren't, then we're a little bit disconcerted because we're quite attached to that image of being a victim. No? And some people just don't buy it. Some people, I mean, I look at people and go, okay, that happened to you in the past. That conditioned what you are. That is not who you are. That is not your identity. You know, that is not some kind of permanent personality. So stop feeling sorry for yourself. Yeah, and so I don't feed into that. And then some people, it's like, but, you've got to feed into it. This is my identity. Okay. Sometimes we have a different identity of, I am so wonderful. You know, I know this, I know that. I know all these important people. I'm very good at what I do. I'm very competent. You know, I'm very responsible. I'm excellent. You know, plus I'm rich and, you know, but that doesn't matter. We know that doesn't matter. But it helps. And and I'm good looking, and we all know that doesn't matter too, but that also helps. And and I'm this, and I'm that, you know. And so we expect people to then kowtow to us, you know, because we are so wonderful and we're so well connected and we're so talented, and you know, therefore we better do everything their way because, you know, they are such an impressive personality. And then, you know, some people buy into that, and again, some people don't buy into it and say, okay, you've done that, that's nice. What are you doing to help other living beings? Yeah, where's your humility? Yeah, if you're so great, then you would really be humble. Because humble people are the great people, not the arrogant people. Yeah, and then again, the people get like, oh, wait a minute, you can't relate to me that way. Don't you know who I am? And say, yeah, I know who you are. You're a mother sentient being, just like everybody else who wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer and whose mind is overwhelmed by afflictions. So why do you think you're so special? You know, I can care for you just as you are. You don't have to be the top dog on the pile, and you don't have to be the victim, the bottom dog on the pile. You know, you can just be you, knowing that's going to change.
So are
you,
is there more harsh words?
Pardon me? Oh, I wouldn't say to them, you know, I wouldn't say, you know, kind of cut out your pity party, you know. But my mental attitude is I'm not falling for the pity party. The same thing the person who comes on really fantastic, you know, I don't say to them, you know, what have you done to benefit sentient beings and where's your humility? I mean, that doesn't benefit them. But, you know, in my mind, I don't fall for this image of here's this, you know, fantastic person that, yeah, okay. I do have some control over my mouth occasionally. Okay. Yeah, so, you know, I'm just trying to help you learn how to relate to this text and, you know, when our, you know, our faults are being pointed out so meticulously. Aren't they? Yeah, he doesn't miss a single one. Okay, so that was one thing. I want to recite the Four Immeasurables like I did yesterday, also as a way of beginning the teachings. And then maybe we'll discuss them a little bit. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. So yesterday we talked about the first one, love. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. And that actually brings up the whole topic of what is happiness and what are the causes of happiness. Okay, because we usually think of happiness as sense pleasure, but from a Buddhist viewpoint, there's many different kinds of happiness, especially the happiness from freeing ourselves from the afflictions. And normally we think of the causes of happiness as external objects and people. Again, from a Buddhist viewpoint, we think of the causes of happiness as our good actions, our positive karma, okay, positive mental states. So it's a whole other meditation to ask yourself, what is happiness? Yeah, and what is the causes of happiness? Maybe we'll talk about that this afternoon in the discussion. It's quite interesting. Okay, so the first one was about love, and as I was saying yesterday, that's our basic approach to living beings, you know, an attitude of, I want you to have happiness and its causes, an attitude of friendliness, of kindness, Yeah. So that whoever we approach, that's the way we approach them, rather than with suspicion or fear or desire, you know, or wanting something out of them. And then the second one, may all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. That is compassion. Okay, compassion, simply that very profound wish in our own heart that others be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And this brings up the whole discussion as to what is suffering. Actually, the word suffering is not the correct translation of the Pali and Sanskrit term dukkha, which is, you know, the term that's being translated. So dukkha, you know, when we talk about the Four Noble Truths, we usually say truth of suffering. It's the truth of dukkha, okay? Dukkha means unsatisfactory conditions. And the reason why suffering is a bad translation is that often people then think that the only thing that plagues us is, you know, strong physical or mental suffering, which everybody recognizes. But when the Buddha talked about dukkha, that strong physical and mental suffering was only one type of dukkha that he was talking about. Okay? And if we translate it as suffering, then we think, well, all the rich people and the famous people don't have any suffering. Actually, they have a ton of dukkha. They have a ton of unsatisfactory conditions. Okay? So when we talk about dukkha, the three types, one is the obvious physical and mental pain that all living beings don't want. Everybody doesn't want that. Even the animals, even the little ant, yeah, even the turkeys outside and the birds, nobody wants physical and mental pain, okay? But it's not only that we're trying to get rid of in our Dharma practice. The second type of dukkha is called the dukkha of change. And it is what we commonly refer to in the world as happiness. Okay. Now this one requires some explanation. Yeah. Why do you say the kind of happiness I experience is unsatisfactory? Yeah, why is it dukkha? Why is it unsatisfactory? Well, if we look, the worldly happiness we experience through getting external objects and being near people and so on, that kind of happiness is very unstable. It doesn't last long, does it? Yeah. And not only does it not last long, but if we keep having it, actually, it begins to feel very uncomfortable and we want to be free of it. Okay, so Prince Charming, yeah? Prince Charming shows up. I am over delighted, over the rainbow with love for Prince Charming, yeah? And this is true happiness. Now, imagine you were with Prince Charming 24/7 for a week. Are you going to feel the same way with him, about him being with him 24/7 for a week? No. Yeah. Because you're going to see him when he's exhausted, when he's in a bad mood, when he first wakes up in the morning, when he's irritable, yeah, when he wants something that you don't want, when he doesn't want what you want. Yeah. And pretty soon it's like, get me away from Prince Charming. Get me a break from this guy. Okay? So it's very interesting. You know, if we look at any of the things that we call worldly happiness, if we have them for any length of time, they become uncomfortable. Okay? Yeah. You're hungry, so you sit down to eat. There's this fantastic meal, and you eat and eat, and you can have all the chocolate cake you want. Okay? And so if chocolate cake had inside of it real happiness, the more chocolate cake we ate, the happier we would be. Okay. So you keep eating chocolate cake. Do you get happier after you eat one chocolate cake? Yeah. Two chocolate cakes, three chocolate cakes. What happens? You know, it's like, oh, there's no happiness in this chocolate cake. I never want to see chocolate cake for another month. Okay. So we look at it, you know, and that is what makes worldly happiness unfulfilling, unsatisfactory. Because the things we call happiness are not true happiness. They're actually discomfort when the discomfort's still small. Okay. So you're hungry. When you start eating, the discomfort of eating is small. So you call that, oh, fantastic food. But as you eat more and more, then the discomfort of eating, you call, it becomes quite manifest. You call that pain. And then you say, I don't want to eat for a while. And at the beginning, then not eating feels really good. But again, after a while, then you want to eat again. Okay? So this kind of worldly happiness is unstable and not very fulfilling. So when we say that we want to be free of suffering and its causes, suffering also includes this kind of thing, you know, I want to be free of dukkha and its causes. So this kind of worldly happiness that is unstable and unfulfilling. Then the third kind of dukkha. Sure.
Isn't it really our attachment to things that is the cause of the pain rather than the object?
Yes. Yeah, very much. Our attachment is the problem that we have. But whether you're attached to chocolate cake or not, you do feel sick after you eat a lot of it.
What if you're on a beach and you're looking at a beautiful sunset?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You see that you're going to be disappointed if you expect the sunset to be there forever.
But, right.
You know, being realistic, you know the sun will go down and you won't have the sunset.
Right. Right. Yeah. So if we have that kind of perspective, accepting that things are transient, then we're able to enjoy them while they're there. And then when they stop, we're okay. Yeah. So we're not saying don't enjoy things. That, you know, Buddha never said don't enjoy things. Buddha wants us to be happy. But, if we're attached to the sunset, or if we see the sunset as something permanent that's always going to be there and not change, then when it changes, we get very unhappy. But when we accept the reality of the object's nature, then the attachment doesn't function. We can enjoy it when it's there, and then when it stops, we're not bummed out. Okay, does that make some sense to you? Yeah, I mean, same thing with Prince Charming. If you know, okay, Prince Charming is an ordinary sentient being who's going to get in bad moods, who's going to blame me for his problems, who sometimes is very wonderful to be with and sometimes not, you know, then if I can accept Prince Charming as, you know, he's not really so charming, he's just what he is, and if I can love him for what he is, then we're going to have a good relationship. Because I accept that, yeah, he gets in a bad mood, and yes, he blames me, and all this stuff, and I'm not going to expect anything more. Like he's going to fulfill all my needs forever and ever. Okay? So the trouble we get into in our relationships is when we think that you know, we project all these expectations onto somebody that they can't possibly fulfill. And also, if we expect the other person and or the relationship to be permanent, to never change, that gives us a lot of pain because, you know, relationships change and people change, don't they? And we have no control over it because also we change. So if I can accept that, you know, my relationship with the prince now is, you know, it's a good relationship, but that he's going to change and I'm going to change, then when we both change, you know, I can adjust to that without going, ah, what happened? You know, and when the prince dies, I can say, yes, I was aware that he was going to die all along. I never expected anything other than that. I never expected to be able to be with him forever. Okay? So it's the thing, you know, what gives us so much problem is that we don't see, we don't understand things as they are. And so thus we have all sorts of false expectations and preconceptions about them. Okay? So the third kind of dukkha is the dukkha of just having a body and mind under the control of ignorance and karma. Okay? Now you're going to say, what? But this body and mind is who I am. You mean this whole thing is unsatisfactory? Okay, well, first of all, we aren't our body and mind. Yeah. I mean, think about it. Are you your body? If you're your body, which body are you? The baby body? The toddler body? The adult body? The 90-year-old body? Which body are you? Yeah. If you're your body, what part of your body are you? Sometimes we have the feeling that if we just opened up the inside, me would pop out. There I am. You know. And they used to have this, what did they call it? Like in the pituitary gland, the homunculus? You know, there was supposed to be this little guy who was, you know, who we really were. Yeah, do you really think that, you know, they cut open your body and you come out? Do you think your brain is your body? Yeah? I mean, not your brain is your body. Do you think your brain is who you are? You know, if the brain is the person, then when Prince Charming's brain is out there on the table, oh, I love you so much. Yeah? Is his brain who he is? Do you love that brain? Oh, your dopamine is so wonderful. Oh, that carbon. Marvelous. Yeah. The nitrogen is glistening. I love that brain. Yeah. Of course, a person is not their brain. Okay. But we've taken this body, you know, under the influence of our self-grasping ignorance. They say be careful what you want because you might get it. And in this case, we got the body that we wanted. And it's a body that gets born, gets old, gets sick, and the finale is it dies. Is that a fantastic situation to be in? Is that satisfactory, to have a body that gets born, old, sick, and dies? It's not satisfactory. But then our mind goes, but it's all I know. If I don't have this body, who am I going to be? What am I going to do? How am I going to have happiness? I've got to have this body. And if I don't have this body, I've got to have another one. So that kind of grasping is what makes the karma ripen at the end of our life that throws us into taking another body. Okay, and so this is what we mean by cyclic existence. We take one body after another body with a mind under the influence of ignorance. Yeah, not a great situation when you really think about it. Now, of course, in our own limited ability, it's all we know. That's one of the things when you start studying the Dharma, you realize, oh, but there's much more available than this kind of body. Okay, there's much more available. Yeah. Like a body made of light, a body that doesn't get old and sick and die, a body that is the manifestation of wisdom, a body that can appear spontaneously and go out to all living beings in every corner of the universe and work for their benefit. A body that doesn't experience physical pain because the mind has eliminated all non-virtue. Okay, so we begin to see, oh, there's another way of being that if we're able to free ourselves from the self-grasping ignorance and also the self-centered mind, there's another way of being that is available. Yeah, that we don't have to be stuck with this present situation forever and ever. Yeah, because the present situation really, it's not such a hot one, is it? Yeah, if you think about it, from the very moment we're conceived in our mother's womb, we're in the process of aging and dying. Yeah, that, of course, that's not how society thinks of it. Yeah, society says, oh, you're born, now you're growing up. Yeah, aging happens later. Have you ever noticed how your definition of old changes each decade? Yeah? Yeah, I remember in my 20s, I had a friend who was 40, and she was so old. Yeah? Now I'm 63. 40's really young. You know, my dad, he's going to be 93 in June. He's old. Yeah? So later on, I'll get old, you know, some other time. Yeah. And if I live to be 90, then I'm sure I'll think 110 is old, you know. So it's very strange in our society. We idolize youth, and nobody is becoming younger. And if that isn't crazy making, yeah. I mean, we're all getting older and uglier, aren't we? Yeah? I mean, you think I'm telling one of your private secrets? Nobody's supposed to know that you're getting older and uglier and having more gray hair and more wrinkles. Nobody's supposed to know. Look at my Botox. I look young. Yeah? Hey, yeah. Then they look at me and say, well, you shave all your gray hair off, so what are you talking about? Yeah, well, it's the reality of the situation. So we might as well enjoy it. Yeah, be able to age gracefully, accept aging for what it is. I think we should go back to the way society used to work, where people really had respect for people who are older, yeah? Because you do, you know, hopefully develop some wisdom through living. Okay. Of course, you know, it's amazing. When I was 16, I was almost omniscient. I knew everything. Yeah, I was a 16-year-old know-it-all. So almost omniscient at age 16. At 63, I'm substantially stupider. You know, I know what I don't know now, which is, I think, some wisdom in the situation. Anyway, so when we're saying that we want sentient beings to be free of dukkha and the causes of dukkha, when we're generating compassion, this is what we're wishing them to be free of, you know? And when we say all sentient beings, it also includes ourself. Yeah. We're not saying that I don't wish myself well and I only wish others well, which I think is the problem in translating self-centeredness as self-cherishing, because it makes us think self-cherishing is bad, so I shouldn't cherish myself. Yeah, I should beat up on myself. You know, you think the Buddha needs to teach us how to beat up on ourselves? Does the Buddha need to teach us how to have low self-esteem and be self-critical and put ourselves down? Is that a virtuous state of mind? Hello? No, it's not a virtuous state of mind. Do you think the Buddha needs to teach us how to hate ourselves? No, he doesn't need to teach that. We do that all by ourselves. We feel guilty, we feel shame, we think we're incompetent. All that rubbish we put on our own head. And it truly is all rubbish. Okay? So I think we should cherish ourselves. We're a living being with the Buddha potential. We have something valuable inside of ourselves. We should cherish ourselves. We should respect ourselves. Yeah, and we can do that without being self-indulgent and without thinking we're more important than everybody else. Yeah? But I think having self-confidence and respecting ourselves, having a sense of integrity, I think that's very important for being able to practice the path. Because if we think that we're just, you know, insufficient crumbs on the floor, then we don't have the confidence to be able to practice because we're already telling ourselves that we can't. Do you know what I mean? Yeah? Our Western culture especially, we have so much problem with this low self-esteem and guilt and shame and all this kind of stuff. And those states of mind, they are all manifestations of self-centeredness. Yeah? When I feel guilty, when I feel shame, yeah, the bad kind of shame, like I'm rotten through and through and defective goods, yeah? Who's the star of the show? Yeah? When you feel shame, when you feel guilt, who's the center? Me, isn't it? If I can't be best, I'm going to be worst. But I am special. I am the worst one in the world. I can make everything go wrong. That's how powerful I am. Yeah, a little bit distorted. Okay, so, you know, I think we need self-respect and self-confidence. Those are not diluted, aspects. His Holiness always says if you're going to practice the Bodhisattva path, you need a very strong sense of self. But you can have that strong sense of self without the self-grasping. Okay, somebody here asked what self-grasping means. The grasping means that you're holding on to the self as existing in a way that it does not exist. You're grasping or apprehending yourself to be an independent entity, separate from everything else, not dependent on causes and conditions, not dependent on parts, not dependent on being labeled,
and the mind that's labeling, you know, but some self-sufficient thing that is there, you know, without depending on anything else. Inherently me. Yeah. So that is a distorted way of apprehending or grasping the self to exist. Yeah, that's the root of all of our problems. But realizing that the self is a dependent phenomena, depends on causes and conditions, depends on other factors, depends on being conceived and labeled, you know, then that dependently existent self, yeah, which does not exist in and of itself, which does not support itself or exist under its own power or exist as a self-controlled entity, but exists dependently on other things, that dependently existent self can have a sense of self-confidence. Yeah? Because it knows, oh, I'm dependent, therefore I can change. Yeah? If I condition, you know, if the conditioning I'm exposed to is different, then who I am changes. Okay? So, generating compassion is what that is all about, wanting sentient beings to be free of their, you know, self-grasping ignorance and the karma that it produces and the rebirth that it produces, you know, plus those three, you know, those three kinds of dukkha. So while love or loving kindness or sometimes friendliness is our natural, spontaneous approach, the first approach, the first way we interact with others, then compassion follows. In other words, we react with love. I mean, we interact with love. May you have happiness and its causes. But then when we see people who are miserable, who are suffering mentally or physically or in whatever way they're suffering, then we respond to the suffering with compassion. Okay? Lots of times we don't respond to people's suffering with compassion. Sometimes we respond to suffering with blaming the person. Yeah? This happens in my country a lot. Yeah, you're poor, that's because you're lazy and you're stupid and you don't try hard enough. Don't you know this is the land of equal opportunity, and so if you only worked harder, you should be able to succeed? Yeah, and so we blame people who are poor, not realizing that, hey, you know, the playing field was not created equal. Some people were born with a much nicer playing field than other people. Yeah, so don't blame people for, you know, their suffering, for their poverty, because they had different conditions, you know, surrounding them. Okay, sometimes, you know, we get angry at people when they're unhappy. Yeah, why are you in such a bad mood? Like, just get out of it. I can't stand you when you're like that. We can respond with compassion, wanting them to be happy, but that doesn't mean that we baby them and we pamper them in their bad mood. But at least we don't get angry at them. Okay? Then the third immeasurable, may all sentient beings never be separated from sorrowless bliss. This is joy. Yeah? This is taking joy at others' good qualities, good experiences, virtue. Yeah. So joy is a response that we, you know, just as we train our mind to have loving kindness as the initial way of engaging, compassion as the way of responding to beings who are suffering, then when beings are doing very well and having success and happiness and creating virtue, our response is joy. We rejoice in their happiness. So this is the opposite of jealousy. Jealousy does not rejoice in others' happiness. Jealousy says, it's not fair. I should have that, not you. I deserve it, not you. I'm going to make it so that you suffer. So that even if I can't have what you have, at least you don't have it anymore. And that's a miserable state of mind, isn't it? I find jealousy so unbearably painful. Yeah. I went through a stage in my life where I was so jealous, and it was so painful inside that I just said, I have to do something. I have to practice the Dharma and get rid of this jealousy because I can't bear it anymore. Yeah. And so you train yourself to rejoice at other people's good qualities and virtues and happiness. And initially the jealous mind says, no way! But then, you know, you see, actually, hey, it's a good thing to do. Then you live up to all your Christmas card wishes when you say, may everybody have happiness. Yeah, so you practice your Christmas card wishes. You know, here's somebody who has happiness. I didn't even have to do anything so that they have that happiness. At least let me rejoice. Yeah. And then when your mind says, but they're better than me. Yeah, my response to that is, good. I'm glad somebody's better than me. Because if I were the best that we had in this world, we would be in difficult straits. Okay? We wouldn't have any food because I don't know how to farm. We wouldn't have shelter because I don't know how to build buildings. We wouldn't have clothes because I don't know how to make cloth. We wouldn't have electricity because the only thing I know how to do is turn the light switch and occasionally change a light bulb. But anything more than that, mm-mm. Yeah, we wouldn't have plumbing because I don't know how that works either. Yeah, I'm actually quite happy there's people who know more than I do. Yeah. So can I look at other people and rejoice at their success, rejoice at their knowledge, rejoice that they have good opportunities, rejoice in their virtue? Why do I have to compete with everybody all the time? Yeah. Why do I think I have to be best? It's good that I'm not the best. Yeah. I'm glad in the Dharma that there's people who know more than me. If my understanding of the Dharma were the best, forget it. Yeah. It's good there's people who know more, who are better practitioners. Okay? So rejoice, you know, we train our mind. All these four immeasurables, we have to train our mind. Yeah. We have to practice it. We have to come back to it again and again. Yeah. To rejoice in others' virtue. And then the fourth immeasurable, may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. That is equanimity, okay, the immeasurable equanimity. Yeah, and here we're really hoping that everybody can have a balanced, equal-hearted openness and acceptance of others. So equanimity is what we practice when people are doing well and they don't need our help. Okay? We interact first with love. When they're suffering, we interact with compassion. When they're doing very well, we interact with rejoicing and joy. And when they're doing fine and can manage their own things, we react with equanimity. We don't interfere in their lives. We don't try to control them. We also react with equanimity when other living beings are shut down and don't want to accept any help. Okay, so there's two situations in which we train in equanimity. One is when they can manage their own affairs and we don't need to help or interfere. We just accept what it is and give people space. The other one is when people are very shut down and they're resistant and they don't want any help or any advice. Then again, we give them space, we step back, yeah, instead of saying, "But I'm trying to help you, you idiot, your life is a mess, why don't you listen to my advice?" Yeah, instead of reacting that way, we say, "Boy, this person's really stuck. Yeah, their mind is very stubborn. They're suffering from afflictions at this moment. I have compassion that they're suffering in this way. And I also realize that there's really nothing I can do about it at this particular moment. But I have to keep the door open." So instead of getting mad at that person for not accepting my help, yeah, I keep the door open, I step back, and when that person is ready for help or when they need a friend, they'll let me know. But if I shut the door, then when they're ready for help, they won't come and talk to me at all. So I have to keep the door open. This is difficult, okay? And this is a mental state that it can be very useful to practice in our families. Because we all know that we see other people's faults much better than they see their own faults. Yeah. Of course, they see our faults much better than we see our faults too, but they're not supposed to do that. But, you know, we see their faults, and sometimes we reach out to them. Yeah? You may have a sibling, and you can see that their behavior is going to create the cause for, you know, a marriage that, for marital problems. Or you can see that the way they're, you know, talking to their kids is going to create the cause for a damaged relationship with their child. Or you can see that the way they're drinking and drugging is going to destroy their health. Or you can see, you know, the way they drive is, you know, perilous. And you try and say something with a kind heart to benefit them. Yeah, I'm not talking about the times when we have an agenda and we're trying to control them. That's another mental state. But when we actually, with a kind heart, are trying to help them, and they just refuse. Yeah, mind your own business. Get off my back. Leave me alone. I know what's best for me to do. Who do you think you are interfering in my life? Yeah? So when somebody has that attitude and they're shut down, we just have to back away and give them space. And it's hard. Yeah, it's what we were talking about yesterday when we see people making really bad decisions and how difficult that is. Yeah, to just not interfere. Yeah, because they're not receptive. Okay, so of course our tendency is, "You don't want my help, you're blaming me because I'm trying to help you. Well, get away from here, you know. Go to hell for all I care. Don't come back and ask me for help afterwards because I'm trying to give it now and you're digging your own grave." Yeah, that's closing the door. When the person, you know, hopefully someday they will come to their senses. if we leave the door open, then they're going to feel coming. They're going to feel okay coming back. If we slam the door closed because we're angry, yeah, then we're going to suffer from anger. And, you know, someday if it happens that they are receptive, they're, you know, they won't come to us. Because they'll expect us to be angry and belligerent. Okay? So equanimity is very valuable. It's like somebody has this problem. I tried to help. I cannot control them. I have to let things be. And just do the taking and giving meditation, because that keeps me involved on an emotional level. Yeah. I do the taking and giving meditation. I make prayers and aspirations for them. And I just accept what is. Difficult. Difficult. Because one part of our mind really wants to control other people. Very hard to accept that we can't. Yeah. And I think this is especially hard for parents. Yeah? How many of you are parents? Yeah, is it hard for you to sometimes watch what your kids do and to accept what your kids do? Yeah, it's hard sometimes. And you know that, you know, you did your best as a parent. You know, whatever you were capable of doing, you did to give them the skills that they need to live as an adult. But now you cannot control them. When they were little, you could control them. You could protect them from danger and pain, you know, as much as was in your power. But when they're older, you can't do that. And they don't want you to do it. And they have to learn through their own experiences. And it's hard sometimes to watch your children, who you love so dearly, go through difficulty in order to learn. And sometimes they don't learn from their difficulties. You know, so all you can do is be there, support, yeah, make prayers, and give them space. Hard practice. Okay, any questions about the Four Immeasurables? Yeah.
Just one question about compassion.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very close friend who got into a relationship with a lady that is in a lot of debt, and he had saved up a lot of money, and he gave her a lot of money, so we're talking like in thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And she basically took it quite selfishly and left him and left without debt. But now he's in a situation where he's quite poor. Barely any money he has. He's hit homelessness now. And he's very impoverished, and he's finding it very hard to see how that works, that he showed compassion to somebody, but it's put him in such a bad position.
Okay. Okay. So he very generously gave money to a lady friend. Yeah, and then she left him, and then he's impoverished, and he's going, but I was so generous, so how come it turned out like this? Sometimes when we're generous in that way, it's not really out of care and concern that we give. It's out of attachment. Yeah. Oh, here's... You know, he's thinking, here's my lady friend. She's so wonderful. I want her to be happy because she makes me happy. And the expectation is, you know, she's always going to make me happy, and she's this wonderful kind of person, and she's never going to leave me. So he was operating under the influence of ignorance and attachment. And so he didn't make a wise decision. because all that money that he gave to her was not really what was going to make her happy, and giving her all that money was not what was going to make her love him. Yeah? So his ignorance and his attachment fooled him. So hopefully, if he can understand that process and say, oh, you know, I was not thinking clearly. I didn't make a wise decision. Money is not going to buy me love and care. Yeah. And generosity does not mean I give everything away. Yeah. It means I have the wish for everybody to have what they need, but I also have to be practical. And being practical does, you know, I'm not selfish when I'm practical. So hopefully, you know, if he can learn that, then he can say, okay, you know, I don't need to feel hurt. I don't need to feel angry. I can accept responsibility and learn from this. And then in the future, you know, not make the same mistake again. Hmm? Yeah. Yes, yes, that's another way to explain it. Yeah, may they never be separated. Sorrowless bliss refers to nirvana or liberation. So may they never be separated from that. Yeah, so yes, it does refer to that. But here I'm talking in a practical way of rejoicing at other people's, you know, virtue and good qualities and so on. Yeah, there's different ways to see that third immeasurable. Anything else? Okay, let's start the session with some meditation. My introductions get longer and longer, don't they? Let's come back to our breath, let the mind settle. You can do the breathing meditation in this meditation period, or maybe you want to reflect on the four immeasurables and really try and cultivate them in your own mind, train your mind in each of the four. So if you wish to do that during this meditation time, please do. Okay, I thought maybe I'd just do a little bit with the questions here. A question that came up yesterday when we were talking about lying. If we don't reveal something we are ashamed of from 30 years ago to a new relationship, is this lying? I don't think so, you know. I think you, if somebody asks you directly about that and you say no, 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 when the answer is yes, 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 that's clearly lying. If it's something that you think the other person should know and you feel very ashamed of it and you're not sure whether they are going to accept you if they learn that about you, I would say, personally speaking, but people may differ on this, that I would try and find the right time and tell that person, and if they were able to accept that about me, then I knew they are a person I can trust. But if that person does not accept that about me, then they're probably not the kind of person I want to have a close relationship with in any case. That's my personal take on it. People may differ. And what if we don't know that someone close will be okay with the truth? Oh, no. I mean, I have family members that have, in so many words, told me in certain situations, do not tell me the truth. You know, they never said blatantly, don't tell me the truth. But in so many words and in examples, one person in particular basically said, I don't want to know about this. Yeah. So I honor that person's request. I mean, actually, this I'll tell you the situation because it probably makes a difference what the situation was. My mom had died about 5.5 years ago, but when she was alive, so many years ago, she was telling me the story about one of her friends whose daughter had a brain tumor, and the daughter told my mom's friend about, you know, her mother, about her brain tumor. And so, of course, my mom's friend was worried about it and so on and so forth. But the way my mother, and then my mom said, I don't know why she told her mother that. You know, it's only going to make her mother worry, and there's nothing she can do, and it's only going to cause pain. She should have just dealt with it herself. So, and, you know, the message my mother was telling me was, if you ever have a severe health problem, don't tell me, because it will be too painful and uncomfortable for me. And I also watched in my family how people didn't tell other people about certain things because they felt that they were trying to protect those people from experiencing pain, which is probably why I have the opposite reaction of, my goodness, I can handle the truth, tell me, you know, because there was so much of this, you know, assuming somebody couldn't handle it and not telling them. So, you know, when after my mom said this, I knew, okay, if I ever get very sick, she really sincerely doesn't want to know, and I will honor that request. Yeah. So, you know, it probably would depend a lot on what the topic was here, if you're not sure if the other person's going to be okay with the truth. It would depend, I think, a lot on what the topic was, why they, you know, did they tell you directly, I don't want to know, or is it more you would like to tell them, but you don't know the, you know, how they're going to react, if they'll accept it or not accept it. So then you just have to use your judgment, and it's going to depend on what kind of relationship you have with that person, whether you decide to tell them and see what happens, or whether you decide, you know, gee, I don't know how they're going to react, and so maybe this just isn't the best thing to disclose at this particular moment. So I think it depends on the situation, depends on your motivation, yeah, depends on, would you like to tell them, but you're not sure if they're going to freak out? Or is it you really don't want to tell them because you feel bad about it and you're afraid they're going to freak out? Those are two very different motivations and situations on our own part. So it's going to be different, yeah, how you respond. I think whenever there's a situation in which we want to lie, then we need to look, why do I want to lie? Because like I said, you know, just ask Bill Clinton about it. What did I do that I don't want somebody to know about? Yeah, why did I do that action if I don't want anybody else to know about it? Yeah, why did I get involved in that? Because if I don't want anybody else to know about it, it's probably because that action wasn't very ethical. Yeah, because if I did an ethical action, then who cares who knows about it? Doesn't really matter. Nobody's going to think bad, or if they do, so what? You know, I acted ethically. But it's usually when, gee, I did something that was not so ethical, that was not so kind, and that's why I don't want other people to know about it. So if that's the case, and that's why we are wanting to lie or to not to keep the truth to ourselves, then I think it would really be helpful to do some purification practice. Yeah. And really be able to look honestly at that situation and, you know, what was going on in my mind that I got involved in that? If that was the wrong way of thinking, why was it the wrong way? How can I look, if a similar kind of situation comes up in the future where I'm tempted to act in that way, how else can I look at it so that I don't do that same unethical action again? Yeah, and to make a strong determination not to do it again, to try and repair the relationship as much as I can, to do something wholesome as a way of, you know, repayment and setting it right. Yeah, so I think if we go through a purification practice with regard to those actions that we don't feel very good about having done, then through doing the purification, we come to accept the situation. We stop feeling ashamed, even though we still feel regret, because shame and guilt are very different from regret. So we still feel regret, but we don't feel ashamed. We don't beat ourselves up about it. Okay, and we've learned from the situation and have a positive way that we want to continue going in the future.
So when you have done that, or anyone has done all that, mm-hmm. So basically, you see it a bit here with politicians, you know, so people have done something in the past, have done the work, and purified it, and move on, and then 15 years or 20 years later,
Yeah, it comes out.
So, yeah. So
yeah. And we have to accept that fact.
So would you be able to say, like, if you go into a position of, you know, politician or another form of leadership, and to disclose everything what you have done 15 years ago?
I think if you're a politician, you definitely should do that, because the media is going to find out anyway. Yeah, the media is going to find out. They're going to disclose it. It's much better if you do at the beginning. And then if people don't like you because of it, what to do? do something else. You don't have to be a politician then.
But you
think general people adapt, right? Yeah, it sure does. You know, and, you know, so it depends on the situation. You may say, well, actually, you know, maybe I won't disclose it right now, but I will disclose it later. You know, sometimes with somebody with a prison sentence, you know, which, you know, they face, at least in the U.S., a lot of discrimination if they're trying to get a job after they've been imprisoned. Yeah, same here. Yeah, so somebody may say, okay, they may think, okay, I'm not going to tell them at my initial job application, but, you know, if I get the job and I work for them and they can see what I'm doing, that I do good work, then I'm going to tell them. Yeah, so they don't have a motivation for long-term concealment. They're just trying to get the job. Other people may say, well, no, I'm going to tell them right off the bat. Yeah, and then it's interesting, you know, because I work with inmates, and so I see, you know, the guys that I work with face this problem, and some people, you know, say, oh, you've had a sentence, we're not going to hire you, and other people say, wow, I really respect that you told me that, and I hope our company will give you a chance. Yeah, so different people respond differently. But, you know, and I see with the guys I work with, I mean, there's one man in particular, I know I'm very confident he's not going to reoffend. And yet he faces all this discrimination and when he tries to get a job. And it's just something that he has to accept, you know. Unfortunately, we don't think of these results before we do actions, do we? You know, we just, like in the heat of the moment, we're not thinking clearly, we do something stupid. And then we just have to say, you know, I have to accept the results of my own actions, even though they're very unpleasant. And this is the wheel of sharp weapons returning upon me. And so I'm going to learn from this situation and not do this again. A what person?
Another person has a crutch against you and try to dig, you know, dig deep to find something that they can sort of teach you.
Yeah.
Their motivation is totally wrong.
Yeah, right.
So in that circumstances, what would happen with a particular person who has the wrong intent?
Okay, so you're talking about you've done something wrong. And somebody else is going to try and find out what you've done wrong because they have a nasty motivation. You generate compassion for them. They have a nasty motivation. They're suffering from that. Yeah? It's right to be reminded. Okay, so how to practice, huh? Study the teachings. Yeah, you're very fortunate here at Chenrezig. You have very good teachers, and so study as much as you can, and then learn how to meditate on those teachings, you know, reflect on them, even if you don't sit in meditation position. Reflect on them, think about them, apply them to your own life. There's a book called Guided Meditations on the Stages of the Path that I prepared. I don't know if it's in the bookshop here. Does anybody know? Is it there? Yeah, okay. So that might be a good one because it has a CD in it with a lot of recorded guided meditations, you know, that can help you in learning to how to contemplate the different stages of the path that the Buddha taught. So that can be something good to do. With purification, there's some practice, specific practices we do for purification, which you can learn about as you learn the Dharma. One is called Prostrations to the 35 Buddhas. Another one is called Vajrasattva practice. But basically, all the purification practices involve four, what we call the four opponent powers. So first one is regret. Second is restoring the relationship in our own mind. In other words, generating a respectful or compassionate attitude towards whoever we harmed. Third is making a determination to avoid that kind of behavior in the future. And fourth is doing some wholesome action, you know, as a way of setting things right and directing your energy in a good direction. And so those four together really help us to purify. And purification is quite powerful. Yeah, I really recommend it. The third one? First was regret. Yeah, regretting our negative actions. And regret is different from guilt. Regret is, I wish I hadn't done that. Guilt is, I'm so terrible. Oh, nobody's going to forgive me. You know, okay. So don't do a guilt trip on yourself. Okay, so let's dedicate. The four opponent powers, if you miss them, I think they're listed in Open Heart, Clear Mind, and in Buddhism for Beginners, both of which are in the bookstore. So, and they're also listed in many Dharma books. Okay. So dedication on page 17. May I quickly become Guru Lord Buddha and lead each and every sentient being to his enlightened realm because of these merits. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta, which has not arisen, arise and grow. And may that which has arisen never diminish, but increase more and more.